Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and this is another episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Lucas Neff from Raising Hope. And this was recorded in the beautiful renovated Hotel Lincoln in the heart of Lincoln Park here in Chicago. I know I talked about this on the last episode. I have some good news. My wife and I are getting a new townhouse. We will be moving hopefully in July or June, somewhere in that. So I'm really excited about that. I say I'm excited. I also have a lot of fear and a lot of trepidation. And as you know, I am your podcast Eeyore. The sky is always falling in my life. So it's really hard for me to share you the good stuff. But we are moving. So hopefully I will have my own office because I'm recording this in our bedroom, which I dub the studio, because both my wife and I work out of the house, and I will just say, honey, I'm going to record in the studio, which means I'm closing the bedroom door, and I'm laying on the bed as I record this. I want to just share with you, I guess is the right way of saying it, two little highlights I had over the weekend as we looked at houses. One was we looked at this house up in Highland Park, and Highland Park is this very nice, lot of woodsy kind of, think of John Hughes kind of suburb, John Hughes movies kind of suburb. So we went up there and we asked our friends, Camille and Matthew, who live in Highland Park, which is very far north from the city of Chicago, in case you're Google mapping it. And they met us up there, a nice house, a kind of a Nantucket looking cedar shingle outside. My wife liked it. I, of course, any house I go into, I shut down. It's traumatic. And for me, it's either everything looks great or everything is a piece of shit. I can always find problems with it. So we go and they bring their kids. And this woman who's just a very unpleasant realtor. There's some nice realtors and there's just some really unpleasant ones. And this woman was just like, you know, I went in there and I said to her, hey, I know you. I see your face on the internet. Nothing. Just stone cold, no response. And I'm the type of person who needs a response. So we're looking around the house. Their little four-year-old, Camille and Matthews, Adrian, he starts playing with the Fisher-Price toys that are, you know, in the little playroom. Well, the woman has a fit and she's saying, stop it. You can't be playing with the client's toys. And I'm thinking to myself, what four-year-old is going to understand the phrase client's toys? The other thing, which I really like, this is another little highlight I want to share with you. This place that we're going to get, and I'm just going to say this, we're getting this place, this townhouse, which is beautiful. It's a three-bedroom townhouse. It's on three different floors. So we look at it. We decide to put a bid in. Then we talk to our realtor. And then our realtor, of course, will talk to their realtor. And what we heard back from through our realtor that their realtor said, if you can follow this, was there was this cute young couple that came to look at the townhouse. The cute young couple was us. And I'm thinking to myself, I just turned 49. My wife is 35. So there's a 14 years difference. On paper, there's 14 years. But in person, I look more like 56. And my wife looks more like 28. So in person, there's an even bigger difference. And I'm thinking to myself, they think we're a cute young couple. And I can just tell you this, the cute in the young part comes from my wife. So Lucas Neff couldn't have been more generous with his time. He gave us over an hour, and we sat down, we talked about, I find this to be one of the most fascinating things. He is probably one of the few people ever in improv that started on a major network television show and then discovered improv. And he talks about how he loves it. It's the thing that he loves to do most, even over doing the TV show, which I found really fascinating. He talks about how he got started. I think you're really going to enjoy this. So here it is.
Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
He's a nerd.
Oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah.
This is Jimmy Corain, and this is a very special episode of Improv Nerd. And when I mean very special, I'm not talking about heroin addiction. I'm not talking about sexual abuse. This is just a straight-on interview. And our guest today, you know him as Jimmy Chance on Fox's Raising Hope, and he is Lucas Neff. Lucas, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
And I just want to say we're at the Hotel Lincoln, who have been... We're in the Grant Suite.
Yeah.
You can't get any better than that.
They've been real friendly.
Yeah. And we actually met... I want to say this before, about a month ago in Los Angeles at I.O. West.
Yeah.
Before doing Armando.
Jed
Evelett had introduced me to you.
Yeah, Jed's great.
And I kept saying, oh, he looks like Paul Britton, he looks like Paul Britton. Today, not as much, because you have a beard and your hair is a little different.
Yeah, I cut the mop top off.
Right. And then we did the show, which was really a lot of fun to do. And then I had went back to on the plane with my wife to Chicago, and Raising Hope is on. And she goes, oh, that's Raising Hope. And the reason I like, Stephanie Ware has something to do with the show.
Yeah, she's been writing on the show for the past season.
So I was like, okay, that's Stephanie's show. Mm-hmm. I watched it. I still didn't put it together. Then I come home from Chicago, and you're in town to do the Chicago Improv Festival.
Right.
And there, your picture is on the Facebook page or the internet or whatever, and I say, that's Lucas. I just improvised with him. And then I go and I Google, and then I find out that you're Jimmy Chance after watching the show on Raising Hope. And the thing that I loved is you're an improviser, stand-up playwright, and also grew up in Chicago.
Yeah.
And you grew up in Andersonville, which
right
is on the north side
Boston.
Here. Right there.
Yeah.
And your mom was Irish, your dad was Jewish. How do those two cultures shape your identity?
Well, I think it's sort of, I was always around the theater from a very early age. So, you know, there's nothing...
When you say you were around the theater in early age...
Well, and my mom runs a theater company. She runs a not-for-profit theater company that sort of like works with underprivileged communities. And for the past 30 or so years, she's worked with kids in prison and juvenile detention centers. But I mean that sort of I was always around a theatrical environment where like people writing or singing or rehearsing or, you know, building props. So it wasn't something that was like, this is very much a part of the fabric of my childhood. So I think a lot of other kids are like, when they're introduced to it at a later stage, it's sort of strange or different or novel in a way that it wasn't for me. I was always sort of around it. So I think growing up, I was always like, no, theater, that's just something you can do, you know. And then my father, who's a tiny little Jewish hobbit of a person, I always love to call him a hobbit too, because it drives him nuts. I think just like, you know, there's a...
What makes him a hobbit?
Well, his size and his hairy feet.
Okay.
You know, I think there's a real appreciation of comedy in the Jewish culture.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, my first two CDs that my dad ever purchased for me, the first two albums I ever owned, was a Woody Allen stand-up routine and a Richard Pryor stand-up routine. I remember listening to them every night before I went to sleep. Same with that. I had a Bill Cosby on vinyl that I would just listen to over and over.
And for our listeners, vinyl is records.
Yeah, it's actually pants, vinyl pants.
Yeah, right.
That I would just run my hands along.
Right.
Bill Cosby's face was painted onto the vinyl pants my father owned. It was an interesting time, the 80s.
Yeah. So, did you do any theater with your mom?
No, I was just thinking, I utterly rejected it. I was totally...
Because you weren't going to go into the family business?
No, I just, I had no intention of, going into her... very specifically what she did in her company, though I did work briefly for some odd cash, like carrying boxes backstage.
What would you know is stage crew.
Yeah,
right.
I did stage crew stuff, and I had to dress up as a dinosaur at one point and like dance in the background of a scene when she was doing a show at the Field Museum. But that was the extent of my sort of work with her. No, I had no desire to be in theater. I love movies. I really love movies. I love... I've always loved movies. I used to cut school a lot and, like, trip on down a Blockbuster for those of you who remember what Blockbuster is, it was like a Netflix, but in a real place.
And you actually would go in there and you would rent a movie, and they would give you a... What would they give you, like a VHS copy?
Yeah, VHS.
Or a DVD.
Later on, DVDs. When I was cutting school, it was VHS.
Yeah.
I'd rent like five VHS movies and just sit down at home and eat like a box of donuts and watch movies all day. And my plan was to be a cinematographer. It was to be a DP. And that's what I applied to for college. But I don't know what happened in the processing, but they put me in the performing arts department.
Well, you say it happened mistakenly. What happened? Can you...
Yeah. I applied online, which is probably my first mistake. and then I applied to study film and media history, which is, you know, it's all camera, it's all film. And when I got my acceptance letter, they said, "You've been accepted to the performing arts department." I was like, "What? Word? That's not... I didn't apply for that." But I hate paperwork. Like, fucking can't stand it. So I was like, okay, I guess I'll give it a shot. And my mom was really encouraging because I'd always been a loud mouth. And she's like, "Why don't you just go for it? See if you like it." And so that's when I started acting.
So when you said you were always a loud mouth, give us an example. Growing up, how you were a loud mouth.
You know, I was always a kid who was talking back. From like the age of fifth grade on, like I was really shy until about 10 years old, like never talked much. But then about fourth, fifth grade, I saw The Big Lebowski and Austin Powers, and I had a bunch of friends who were like real, like, you know, punks. And like, I was just like, oh, this is what you can be like this? You can just say stuff back to the teacher? Okay. And I just started talking back, and I don't think I ever stopped at that point.
Did you get in trouble?
All the time. I was a terrible kid. I got suspended a lot in high school. Nothing like, just like stupid things. Like, you know, I didn't get along with some teachers well, and like, there's a teacher talent show, and they're all like studying to be, there's this like group of teachers who were going to be the Temptations, and I really didn't get along with them. They were always yelling at me, or I was yelling at them, and they went out of the room one day, and I opened up all their mics, cut all the wires inside of their microphones, and then screwed them back together. And because I was like, well, you know, F them. But somebody, some rat fink, turned me in.
Do you remember who it was?
No, I don't. Okay. I still to this day have no idea who finked me out. But I got suspended for that. I got, oh boy. Just stupid stuff like
but,
that.
But, you know, when I hear that, Lucas, it's not like, I mean, that took effort. That was like, you were like a smart, you know, like.
That was like an Ocean's 11 type.
Yeah, you were like an overachiever kind of. punk, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you put some thought into it. It wasn't just like letting mice in the cafeteria.
A little bit. I mean, there was also like just impulsive stupidity. Like one time I took a test and I didn't cheat or anything on the test. I took it and it was, you know, I ended up getting a great grade on it, but I saw an extra test lying at the end of the classroom and was like, huh. And so I just took it after I finished the test and then just started selling it to all the kids who hadn't taken it yet. Because I'm like, I'll make an extra buck. And then, of course, some kid... I refused to sell it to one kid because he'd set my friend's hand on fire in chem lab. Uh-huh. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to give you the test. You know, you set Oslam's hand on fire. He's got blisters the size of my face. And then, of course, he was the one who turned me in. Which is... the lesson there is that, you know, you got to be an equal opportunist criminal. You can't turn anyone away. No discrimination in the criminal underground.
And then... so you graduate from UIC. You do a... couple commercials, right? You're with Stuart Talent here, which is also my agency.
Yeah.
And then you get, I think, a guest star on Beast, right?
Yeah, I got like a little three-line part on like the last episode of The Beast.
And then you do a show, Collaboration, right?
Oh, no, the show Collaboration was the first thing I ever did.
Okay.
That was fall 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first professional job I ever had.
And you also meet, at the time, your girlfriend.
Yeah.
Was she your girlfriend when you started?
No. We started dating after the play closed. Kelly O'Sullivan.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in John at Collaboration together.
And how was that?
What do you mean?
I mean, to be... So, she's...
I mean, it was great. It was great. I think, you know, it happens a lot. We call them showmances. You know,
uh-huh.
I'm sure there's sort of when you're in a show and you're in a vulnerable place and... you're playing opposite somebody, there's a real tendency as an actor, I think, to, you know, start... you become very attached to the people you work with, and if you're working with someone who you're supposed to be falling in love with every day, I think, you know, you're training your body to feel something for that person, and I think that it can be very easy. Plus, you're spending a lot of time around them, you get to know each other, you make each other laugh, it's real easy to dip your pen in the company ink. You know what I mean?
But, I did a show with Stephanie Weir, and this was years ago, and I just, you know, she was dating at the time, but I had a huge crush on her.
Well, that makes sense. She's really fucking cool.
She's cool. She's attractive. She's a great writer. She's a great improviser, a great performer.
I think it's natural. You hear about that. Everybody always says, you know, you should never date people you work with. But 90% of the people I know are dating people they work with. And it's just because you're around them all the time. And if you respect them and you like them, it's such the path of least resistance, I think, emotionally.
And you went even farther because you guys got engaged and she moved out to L.A. with you, right?
Yeah. We took it almost as far as it can go. She came out to L.A. with me because I booked the Raising Hope after we had been together for about a year. And, you know, we were in love, and as tumultuous as a relationship as it was, and I think every relationship has its ups and downs, you know, we wanted to try that adventure together. And, I mean, it was great. We learned a lot. You know, we were both kids. Jesus Christ.
Well, because you got you were, what, 24?
I was 23 when I booked it, 24 when we shot the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was, and then later we got engaged. I was engaged at 24. So it was young.
Was it tough to call it? Who called it off?
I initiated the conversation, but it was fairly mutual and incredibly amicable. I mean, we're friends to this day. You know, nobody did anything untoward,
mm-hmm.
which is nice about it, is that we walked away before it got toxic. So we were able to still be friends.
Let's go back to before you get Raising Hope. You're living in Chicago, and according to my research, you're cleaning houses. And then I did even more research, and you really only cleaned one house.
And one house.
Was that the PR people going, let's pump this up a little?
No, okay. It's journalists. It's okay. Terrible, shitty journalists.
Okay, well, I did my research, and I'm not even a journalist. I'm an improviser.
Well, that's probably why you're slightly better than the rest of them. But this thing developed where I was like, you know, the week before I got the audition, I had been talking with my friend. I'm like, we should start cleaning houses because it's great hours. You can make a pretty good amount of cash. Sure, it's hard work, but you're working like 3-4 hours a day, and you can make like, you know, $60 to $100, you know, depending on the gig, depending on the house. And I'm like, this is great for an actor. You know, you flexible hours. You work your own schedule, and it's very little. It doesn't demand that much time from you.
And if there's food in the refrigerator,
you get access. You can steal lamps, and sconces, and whatever small fixtures you can walk away with. You know, not a lot of repeat business.
Right.
And anyway, I had just cleaned my first house. I was desperate for cash, man. Desperate.
Were you living with your parents at that time?
No, I think I was. No, I was staying with... Kelly and I were living together.
Okay.
At that time. But I just crashed nights at my parents' house all the time. I mean, we were like 5 blocks away from each other. So, you know, I'd go over whenever I got too hungry and just eat them out of house at home and then pass out on the sofa and then sneak out the next morning before they saw me. Because I was a good son. But I cleaned one house and then got the audition. And then a couple weeks later, you know, was flown out to L.A., But so in telling that story, these people were like, oh, what a great story. What a great angle that he was cleaning houses. And immediately it became this, like, I was like freaking Cinderella, like sweeping the ashes from the hearth every night. And it's like, no, that wasn't the case. I cleaned one house. But the myth is so much more seductive.
Well, I don't know. Nia Vardalos, My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yeah.
The press always portrays it like, it was one night that Rita Wilson came, and that was the night that, you know, they discovered Nia Vardalos, and then they made My Big Fat Greek Wedding. But Nia had been doing that show for years and years and years and years and years, you know, and had gotten rejection and had gotten option.
The simple A-B Cinderella story is always... It's a fan favorite, you know what I mean? It's something that sells well, it markets easily. It's a lot less... sexy to say somebody worked hard for years and really, you know, had a lot of rejection and then a lot of people said no, as opposed to there was one night they put it up, the star shone, because I think there's something in that anybody can have one great night, you know what I mean?
But
it's a lot harder for people to
I want to know your opinion on this, because I don't think it does. In people that listen to this podcast are primarily their acting improv students. Mm-hmm. I don't think that does them any service. Do you?
No, I don't think so. I think the truth is always the best, servant. truth is the best servant of any master. And I think that's because it's a more realistic, you know how to realistically sort of map out what you're getting into. And I think, you know, whenever I talk to students or anybody who's like, you know, I want to be an actor, I'm like, well, this is what it means to be an actor.
And what does that mean?
There's no guarantees. There's no guarantees. A lot of people have careers because of luck and timing, not necessarily that they're the most talented. And that's the thing, is talent is not a mutually exclusive quality. There's not like a finite amount of talent in the world, and if you have a lot of it, everybody else doesn't get as much. It's like, no, there can be incredibly talented people everywhere, and a lot of those talented people never get the opportunity to succeed.
See, when I look at your career, I think of, he's got to be driven, and he's got to have the incredible confidence. You think that's a fair assessment? But besides talent, I think talent is a given.
No, I think confidence is, and that's something I tell people too. I think, you know, confident people book more jobs. I'd say confidence has more to do with success than talent in a lot of cases, because people walk into a room confidently and it puts everybody at ease. And there's just a certain like, oh no, they're going to do well. And I think you see that on stage in improv too, because I think you know, it's a terrifying place to step on stage and not know what's going to happen in front of a live audience. But the ones who seem confident or are like, no, trust us, we're going to be fine, we know what we're doing, and everything will work out, the audience sort of like buys into it too.
And it's an internal thing, right? Confidence. Where do you think you got yours?
A lot of failure. A lot. I've failed my way up, is what I like to tell people, is that, you know, I played sports for a long time, and like I was just good enough for coaches to have incredibly high expectations, which I would inevitably fail to meet. Like, I was always the guy who like couldn't get it done, you know, would like get real close and then fail. Same with cross country, I'd be a great runner in practice and then like injure myself during the race. And
do you think there was a little self-sabotage going on with you?
Yeah, I think there has to be. That has to be a part of it. There has to be fear. And I think fear, like, tightens you up. And I think, you know, that fear, that tightness leads to injury. That tightness leads to your brain short-circuiting. And that's all fear-related. But I think that, like, I was lucky enough to have parents who, because they were artists themselves, were never, like, success is related to money. They're just like, success is related to happiness, so you have to do what makes you happy, and don't worry about anything else. And so I never quit on anything because of the fear that I wouldn't make any money, or the fear that I was running out of money. I was like, no, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm just going to do it whatever adjustment I need to make in my life economically, like whatever I can't afford to eat or whatever I can't, you know, if there are days where I'm like, well, I can either get coffee today or I can get food, you know, what's it going to be? Because, man, I love coffee. And that was, it was never the conversation, well, if I can't make enough money, what else can I do? It was always, I'm going to do this. How do I survive?
And the first season of Raising Hope, I mean, and you said that you were really afraid. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You thought the show was going to get canceled and everyone was going to get fired because of you.
Yeah.
How, and for people that don't know, I mean, those are long days and it's there's a lot of pressure on. How did you overcome your fear? I mean, you have to show up every day.
I think I was just lucky enough that I've had time. You know what I mean? I think that it just took time of the show not disappearing. And of having days where you're like, oof, man, I was not good that day. Or like, oof.
How did you know you're not good?
You have your own internal metric, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to be, I think, as an artist, you have to be self-aware enough to be self-critical. And you have to be okay with self-criticism. I think there's a point where it gets, you start being a self-defeatist and you start hurting yourself by being hypercritical. But I think you have to be like okay with the fact that, and I say this all the time, like, I'm not good every day. Like, there will be days where I'm not good. Now, does that mean I've lost something or that I don't deserve to be up there because I've had a bad day? It's like, no. You get to a point where you're like, why was I not good? Okay, what can I do to try to stave off that failure in the future? You know, it's the ability to look at a mistake and say, this is an opportunity to learn, as opposed to, this is a mistake I need to give up.
Get tripped up on that part of it, which is I'm not good, now I'm going to quit.
Yeah.
There had to be days where you'd show up and go, oh my God, this is the day I'm going to get fired.
Yeah, I think there were lots of those days, and there probably still will be in the future. I don't think the fear
even
ever
now
goes
in
away.
The third season?
Well, I mean, you still want to do a good job, do you know what I mean? And it sucks to feel like, well, I've been doing this for so many years. Well, that's a sentence. I've been doing this for so many years, and I'm still making... Oh man, that's a really basic mistake to have made. What's wrong with me? And I like to think that you always have to keep remembering old lessons. Like you learn something and you feel like, oh, I got it. And then like, you know, a year later you're like, oh shit, what was that thing? And I think, you know, it's a process of remembering, of like, oh yeah, remember to listen, remember to be truthful, remember to have fun. Like some really basic things that you get, because you get complicated and you get caught up in the details and in the theory and really like really microscopic elements of doing the work, and sometimes it's really important to sit back and be like, am I still having fun?
Do you ever get, you know, you always hear this with especially with sitcom, people are like, oh my, you know, certain characters are getting more storylines or more attention or stuff like that. Do you get bogged down in that?
I think every now and then, like, you're like, oh man, you know, every actor likes to work. And every actor has an ego, and you know, it's really easy to make the connection between an episode that's not too, that doesn't feature you as much, and being like, well, what did I do wrong? How, you know, I must be doing something wrong, and how dare they? You know, because they're fucking idiots, and they should know better. But the nature of serialized television is that at a certain point, the writers get desperate, and they need to just get stories on the page. And wherever the stories come from, that's where it has to go. And you just have to be okay with, like, there will be episodes where you're featured less and episodes where you're featured more. And it's just sort of a continuum. It's very tidal. Like,
does it take comfort? I'm still going to get my, you know, $20,000 or whatever an episode?
You know, I think there's that thought. Sure, where it's like, yeah, well, fuck them. I'm still getting the same. The
right.
Paycheck's the same, you know? But, no, I think at the end of the day, like, I don't know. Maybe it's different for other people, but you really, that connection isn't as strong or vital for me. It isn't about what I make. What I make per episode is not, for me, the point of doing it. Though it's really nice and it saved my life. But when you're in the thick of making the show, I think I'm focused, and I think I'm pretty confidently speak for everybody else, we're all focused on doing the best we can do, and that's sort of what we care, you know, our priority system is just quality. And yeah, you're like, man, I really wanna make sure this week's better than last week, which is better than the week before, and just keep trying to like have that linear progression upwards.
And you got, I mean, you have a great cast. I mean, Cloris Leachman's on it, Martha Plimpton, Garrett Dillahunt. What have you learned from these guys?
I mean, everything. You know, it's sort of been grad school for me in a lot of ways. I think, you know, I've learned really basic technical stuff. You know, stuff about hitting marks better, about where the light is in the room, where the cameras are, what a medium shot versus a close up is versus a wide shot, what you can do differently on your coverage versus someone else's coverage, you know, where your freedoms are as an actor in a very micromanaged environment, how to still have fun, the ability, the different processes that different actors take to scripted work, where, you know, some actors do different things every take, and some actors sort of like find one or two things and sort of hone in on them. And just
what kind of actor are you on?
You know, but I think I'm still figuring it out. I would like to be the actor who does different things. You know, I think that's to me an alluring quality. I'd like to be that actor. I'm not that actor every day. Sometimes my brain is very tired and I can only think of one or two good choices, and then I'm like, well, this is what I got today.
Right.
You know, I also know that I'm better when the better actor I work with, the better I am, which is sort of maybe sad, but like, I know, like, I'm not always a great actor when I'm working with people who aren't pushing me as much. And, you know, that's something I'd like to get better at, I suppose, in the future.
Now, how did you get into improv?
I backdoored it, man. I was like an improv. I was an improv nerd. I in Chicago, I would go to shows all the time. Like I would hang out at I.O. three nights a week, four nights a week. But I was always in the audience because one, I didn't have enough money really to take classes, and two, I didn't really have the time and or the desire to take a ton. Like after I graduated college, I'm like, man, and I did the conservatory, the school at Steppenwolf. And I was like, man, I'm done with school for a while. Like, I just want to play and perform. And I really wanted to do improv, but I know that you kind of have to, you got to go through the schools to get into it. And I tried, like, half-heartedly to take a class or two at Second City and, like, given up midway through it. Just been like, I can't do this. And it's just not my thing. But I was also taking, like, an improv for actors and a comedy writing class. And I think that might have been my, as opposed to just taking the normal progression. But I always loved it, and I was like an improv groupie, like, you know, hanging out. I had a lot of friends who were improvisers in the city, and I would come see their shows and support and, you know, desperately wish that I could be up there playing. And then last year, and I took, when I was in Philly, I took a couple classes. Like, I dropped in on some, like, Harold level 3 sort of improv classes over in Philly with Greg Malm, who's a great guy, who runs FIT. The Philadelphia House Improv Theater, something like that. I forget the acronym. But long story short, I did an Armando at I.O. last year as a monologist.
I.O. West or I.O.
I.O. here.
Okay.
Because I had run, you know Adam Jacobs?
Yes. Who taped all the
tapes improv everything, shows? Yeah.
How did you know Adam?
I did this thing called the Paper Machete.
Yes.
With which Christopher Pyatt
runs.
Mm-hmm. And I had performed in it, and he was like, oh, hey, I didn't know... I didn't know that you did this type of thing. Would you ever be interested in hosting an Armando? And I was like, yeah. This is my golden ticket, like, handed in. He's like, oh, I'll email Charn and let her know. And so I did the Armando, and I met a lot of people, and it was real. It was just a great night. Like, it was just a great night. And Charn was like, anytime you want to drop in on a show or, like, guest, like, play, you know, you're more than welcome. And I was like, okay, when? How soon? And so I dropped in on, like, two or three more shows in the next couple days. And then I told her that, look, you know, when I go back to LA, I would really love and had been thought of, you know, had been desirous of doing a show out there for a long time. What were the possibilities that, like, I could have some type of two-person improv show out in at I.O. West? And she was like, well, let me think of some names, and I'll get back to you. And she eventually was like, why don't you sit down when you're out there and meet up with Craig Kukowski and see, you know, if
who's just a great,
up.
I mean... The guy is a master.
Yeah, well, and this is the thing. Was like, I knew who Craig was. Like,
from here? From
I mean,
from Chicago?
From L.A.
Okay.
I know he had been in Chicago, but that was a little bit before my time. Because he's been out in L.A. now, I think, for about 10 years.
Yeah.
But I, you know, he had taught friends of mine out in L.A. I'd seen his show Dazzariski with Bob Dassey and Rich Tallarico. And
Stephanie.
Yeah.
Oh,
no,
yeah. And then they do another show, Quartet.
Yeah, they do another show, Quartet. But I'd seen them, you know, him doing shows forever and had, you know, I was well aware of the mind and man that I was going to meet, and I was super excited about it. And we sat down and we really hit it off. And so we put a show up on the board of being, he did this First Time with Khaki show where, like, people from the industry who aren't improvisers by trade play it, do a two-person show with him for about an hour. And we had a great time, and we're like, okay, let's try this out. Let's do a show. And so we called it The Better Half. And it's me and him, and we started doing shows out in L.A. last October. And we've done about 11 or so shows now. And, yeah, he's great to work with. He's great because he keeps challenging, you know, he challenges me to be a better improviser and a better artist every time I work with him.
Do you ever feel like, oh, they're just giving me, if it was me and I had a TV show and I didn't take classes, do you ever feel that, like,
I think that's the fear.
Yeah.
I think that's the fear, right? And I think whenever I come home or whenever I'm out, you know, there's the fear. It's like, oh, that fucking asshole TV kid.
Right.
Trying to
see. He just jumped over everybody.
And that's
he's working with Craig Kukowski.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a legitimate complaint. I mean, my only thing to say is like, well, no, I paid my dues. I just paid him in different theaters. Like, I was working for nothing doing scripted work, you know what I mean, for a year and a half out in Chicago, just, you know. And I, you know, I tried to get into the school at Steppenwolf four times, you know, just to take classes there, and I paid a ton of money to take classes to be a better actor there. And it's like, you know, I like to think that I paid dues, but I just paid them in a place invisible to improvisers. But I think, you know, I'm very conscious of when I go into a show and it's my first time playing with a bunch of people, like, I cast myself in the supporting role. Like, if I'm in a big group show, I don't try to get on stage too much. I'm like, this is your guys' show. It's your spotlight. I'll help. You know, I'll come out and, like, I'm going to, like, pick you guys up, but I'm going to establish that I'm low man on the totem pole. And then, you know, as we get to know each other and maybe, you know, we find if we vibe or not, then maybe I'll you know, play a more peer-to-peer type role.
Well,
but
then
I don't try to take over or be the center of attention.
And then the other pressure I would feel is, I'm on this TV show. It's been on for 3 seasons. I've got fans, and I go out there, and they're expecting something from me. Their expectations are higher. How do you deal with that?
Boy, I mean, I think I'm still trying to figure out how to deal with it. You know, I think it's the same thing. It's just it's on steroids a little bit, right? It's the same fear of, like, people have paid to see something happen when you're doing a show, period, whoever you are. You go out there, and if there's an audience, you're like, they expect something of me, and I better deliver. And, oh, God, how do I make sure that happens? And, you know, and I think that's when you start, like, preconceiving and predetermining and being like, well, I know this is funny, and I know that's funny, and here's some funny stuff that happened to me today. Can I work this in somehow? And, like, that's all, I think, fear, right? And then, like, for me, it's just like, well, the expectations must be really fucking high because of the show and all this. And so, man, I better Babe Ruth the fuck out of this show tonight, or I am done for. My goose is cooked. And, you know, you got to somehow, whoever you are, just find a way to shove that to the side, because that's not what helps you have a good show. You know, at least not for me. Like, when I got into acting or, you know, by mistake, but the reason I stayed in it is because I love the feeling of playing in front of an audience. Like, I love the tension that you feel in the air between the audience and performer, where it's like there's a palpable, like, thread that connects you to the audience, and you sort of get to pluck those strings, and you can play with their attention and take them on a real journey. Even as an improviser, and something you might say is, like, with short form, it's just like, oh, we're just doing jokes. But it's like, no, every time you have a live performance, you have the opportunity to take an audience to unexpected and sometimes profound places, and especially with humor. And so, like, I just remember that. Like, remember that you love to do this. Like, you're here because you love to do it, and you're not afraid of it. Like, you're not trapped. No one's forcing you to do this. If it's uncomfortable or awful, stop. You know? Like, no one fucking cares if you go out there tonight. No one's life depends on you performing. So it's like, I hope you're doing it for you, and I hope you're doing it because you love it. Because that's the best, you know, then everything, good things come of that.
What do you do? Because I've had so many shows. I've had shows that I've loved, and, you know, I've been doing it for a long time. And then there's times where I've been on stage where I'm like, oh, I hate it. And I say to myself, you know what, I need to take a break. What do you do when you get on stage and you're like, ah, for whatever reason, it's been a long week, or something emotional happened, or whatever,
no,
I'm not loving it today.
Oh, I think that sort of happened to me recently. I'd done a ton of shows, like, in a row, and by the end of the week, I was just exhausted. And I, you know, somebody asked if I would step in and play in a show, and I was like, okay, you know? And I just I wasn't feeling it the whole show. I'm just, like, just trying to, you know... You're trying to turn your car on, and you just hear it go.
Right. Probably the transmission. Probably the battery.
Yeah.
It's probably something.
Either fucking way, I can't afford to fix it.
Right.
You know?
And I need to be somewhere in 20 minutes.
Exactly. And you're just like, ugh, man. And I think it's important to just listen to that and acknowledge the truth of it, which is like, oh, I need to take a couple nights off. I need to go back and want this again. And it's okay to take a little break. You don't have to fight through it, you know. And that's the thing, is it should never be a fight. Like, you know, I think sometimes, weirdly enough, like, that energy transforms into a wonderful show. You're like, ugh, I really didn't want to do this tonight. But then all of a sudden something happened and it became magical. But I think that's rarer than perhaps we'd like it to be. And I feel like if you're not feeling it, yeah, unless you'll lose your job for taking a night off, you know, sometimes, or just take a back seat. Like, just don't play as much, you know. You got to listen to yourself on that, and if you don't have the juice, then you shouldn't be out there. Though sometimes it's good to just really have a shitty night. I think that can be useful.
Well, what do you learn from that?
That you won't die. You know, that you won't die, that you don't lose all of your friends. Like, you don't turn on your Facebook and your friend count is down to, like, just mom and dad.
Right, you don't have to go on a bender somewhere.
Yeah, that things are okay. I think that, you know, not to devalue failure. Like, don't go up there and be like, oh, it doesn't fucking matter. Bleh.
Right.
But, you know, that you'll be okay. And, like, you know, women or men or whoever, there'll still be women and men out there who find you attractive. You know, you don't, like, sacrifice everything on a bad show, on the altar of a bad show. And also, you know, it's humbling. It's really humbling. And I think humility allows people to listen better, I think. Which is, like, you're really egotistical. When you get too egotistical, you stop listening as much to other people and what other people are giving you, because you're like, I already know. Like, I know what to do, and I know where to go, and I know how to make a great show happen, because I always make a great show happen. And I think when you failed a few times, you're like, well, no, what are your ideas?
Right.
You know?
Maybe tonight I'm going to follow.
Yeah.
I'm going to yes and you.
Yeah, yeah. And I think whatever allows you to listen better is a good thing. And to question yourself, to constantly be like, where can I improve? Because there's always room for improvement. You can always be better. And you should be. You should constantly be striving to be better and, like, work on the things you're weaker at or scared of. Like, wherever you're scared or uncomfortable, that's the thing you should be doing.
Well, you said something interesting. You said that, you know, the biggest challenge to your work is to work on your craft every single day.
Yeah.
What does that mean? I mean, to an actor and an improviser.
I mean, I think that, like... Well, first, to go from the primary understanding that there's always room for improvement, that, and from there, if you can be better, you should be trying to be, right? Like, it's not an understanding of, like, well, I know I could be better, but I'm good enough. Like, I think that's a terrible attitude to have. And if you're then conscious of this space where you're like, I could be better, then it's enough. Then you have to start asking why. Like, why am I not as good as I could be? What are those things that are holding me back? Or how am I holding myself back? And, you know, you sort of go through all the different tenets of the artistry of it. You know?
So give us an example from your life in terms of either acting or improv.
I think, like, okay, here's one where it's like you're doing a scene or something. And
in improv.
In improv or anything.
Okay.
And, you know, like, there's a certain... You know, I think the equivalency between unscripted and scripted here is, like, there are certain jokes that tend to have a percentage of payoff no matter what the circumstances are or how often you do them. There's, like, a certain, like, lowbrow sensibility that will always pay a certain dividends.
Like
a dick joke.
Right.
Or going to sex or going to farts. So scatological humor always pays a certain dividend, I think. And it doesn't, but it's not necessarily related to the characters or the scene or the circumstance. It's not always the truest choice. And I say truest instead of smartest, because sometimes dick jokes can be really fucking smart and you shouldn't underrate them. But there's sometimes better choices to be made, and we don't go to them because we want the laugh or we want the gratification of success more quickly. And so it's like, well, I got to stop being afraid to not go for I gotta stop this fear of that forces me to go for the easy choice. Like, that's something I need to confront, because if I can get past that, maybe it will take me to a better place and an overall better show, and I'll give something stronger to my scene partner as well, as opposed to just being like, and your balls, you know. And I think that like that stuff, you know, there's choices are like,
is that one of your habits or go-tos?
No, not necessarily. I think, like, you know, I tend to curse a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes, like, or conciseness for me is a problem. Like, I'm a talker. And then
so you'll initiate and it'll be like a long monologue.
Yeah, or just like somebody will say something to me and I'll just, like, for me it's like, because I grew up in a talky family, so I talk my way through, like, problems. Like,
mm-hmm.
I think by talking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've given myself the challenge of, like, be concise. Like, when you say something, stop and listen. You know, like...
Say a couple lines versus...
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like, that for me is always something I have to constantly remind myself of. Because even in this, I just, like, want to leap in constantly. And that's sort of the environment I was raised in, Right, grew up in a family of, like, you listened by talking louder.
But it's interesting because you only had one brother. It wasn't like you came from 10 kids.
Well, but my dad is the equivalent of 10 kids.
Was he a pretty...
Oh, yeah, he's...
opinionated.
Huge, and he's bits, like, constant, like, jokes and bits. And
what,
like,
was his sensibility like?
Oh, I mean, he's
Catskillsy?
Like, no, he's like... Oh, he's like 1940s schmaltzy vaudeville Jewish comedian.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, hey!
Right.
Like,
a lot of puns in the house?
Oh, my God. Endless puns. Mm-hmm. Endless puns. Or, like, you know, just like, you know, constant, like, you feel like he's always waiting for the rim job, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everything he says sort of has that vibe to it. And he's just like... He doesn't, you know, he's always just constantly talking and, like, searching for new hilarious things to make himself giggle. And I think, you know, and my mom is just talking, you know, is giving a very, like, direct, stern monologue in the corner over here. And they're both just sort of talking at the same time. And then I'm sort of, like, talking, and my brother's just silent and miserable. And that was just sort of...
Well, at least you learn how to get focus.
Yeah. I mean, and you learn to not be afraid of language. I think that's...
In what way?
Well, I think, you know... Americans in particular, we have sort of a very stunted relationship with higher language. And my father is a writer and was a lawyer for several years, and my mother is a writer, and they both have an appreciation of complicated language and linguistics, and to not be afraid of words and afraid of not knowing what a word means. And so, you know, we talk through things. And I think in this country, you know, we're unfortunately, we don't have an appreciation for language that always goes beyond colloquialisms, and so our ability to express ourselves articulately.
Did you talk feelings? Did you, growing up, were you good communicators?
I mean, this is sort of the thing, and I think, you know, my father would write me letters.
Like, give me an example.
Like, if we'd have a huge fight at a certain point, like...
And now, when you said fight, I mean, tell us, yelling?
Screaming at each other, breaking stuff, like, me breaking stuff, like, tearing shelving off the walls. And this is from a pretty early age where I was just, like, a monster. And, or just yelling at each other, yelling, you know, screaming at each other. And then, like, at a certain point, he would just, like, stalk off. And then the next morning, I would wake up, and there would be a letter from him to me about the fight, where he would try to explain himself and explain where he was coming from and explain what he needed from me. And but it was, you know, it was legalese, you know what I mean? It would be very much like, and here's why, and if you can understand where I'm coming from, and this is the context of it. And I apologize for the emotionality of the you know, it shouldn't have reached such an intense and feverish pitch. But, you know, if I could extend to you my deepest apologies. And just, like, things like, as an 8-year-old, that you really, you're like, what?
So you were the trouble kid. I mean, you were the troublemaker in the family.
Oh, huge. Yeah, enormously.
So now, here you are on this really successful network television show. How's the relationship changed with your family?
Oh, you know, my dad is relieved.
Is he?
Yeah, because he doesn't...
Because he thought you were going to be a fuck-up?
Yeah, he thought I was going to be destitute, starving, and dependent for the rest of my adult life. You know, I think he thought I was going to be living in his basement forever.
Do they say, like, you know, I'm sure when you were 8, what are we doing wrong? Now they're probably going, what did we do right?
Oh, well, I think, you know, and this is the thing, my brother's doing okay, too, and he's an artist as well. He's a painter and a sculptor in New York, and he's got a salaried job at a gallery. You know, he's on staff. He's 23, and he's on staff at some gallery in New York in this terrible economy. And my parents are like, we raised 2 artists, and they're both full-time
right.
paid and supporting themselves.
And they're not asking
okay.
us for money.
Yeah.
We thought at this age they'd still be asking
uh-huh.
us for money.
You just see my dad just, like, rolls around. He's just glowing. He's got this glow all the time now. I mean, it's great. It's great. I'm happy for him because, you know, he's retired now. And he always wanted to be a full-time writer, and now he's finally got the time and the wherewithal to do it.
You know, researching you, I get the sense that you are not only an actor, but you're a creator and a writer. And you wrote a play last year. I think
mm-hmm.
you put it on here in
yeah.
Chicago. What would Lucas Neff like to create next?
Man, that's a good question. I started doing stand-up this year. Oh, this is the thing. I'm actually midway through it. There's 2 things.
Okay.
I'm sort of creating a bunch of different characters, which I like to put up in different environments. And like the one I have at the stand-up character now, Jimmy Connolly. And it takes about 2 hours of prosthetics to get into him.
Explain it. What's he like?
Well, you know, he's very visually notice. He's overtly visually a failure, mm-hmm. and like disintegrating. Like, you know, he's got these enormous glasses that are incredibly thick lensed. You know, his hair. He's got this awful comb over. Like, you know, it's not just that he's bald, but it's that he's done a terrible job combing it over. He's got a paunch that he wears, you know, he wears it terribly. Like, it's, he doesn't dress to look, you know, like his clothing reveal the paunch more than it hides it and anything like that. And then just, he's doesn't have a lot of people in his life. And so he's very much focused on how to be happy at the bottom of the barrel. Like, how do you, what is it that happiness is when you've got nothing?
So give me something he might say.
Well, I mean, that's a tough thing. It's because they're all related to stories. But, like, I have this very elaborate "that's what she said" joke. Because I was like, I'll only do it if I don't tell jokes.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was like, oh, wouldn't it be great if I worked in some, like, really terrible classic punchlines mm-hmm. into these stories? And so I tell this fairly elaborate story of how my first pet died, Wish. Which was that, she, you know, my mother... I came home from school one day and my mother told me that my cat, Wish, who I love dearly, is my best friend, had drank rat poison and been found in a nearby apartment complex basement, curled up in a paralyzed rictus in a pool of drying vomit and excrement. And I take a pause, and then I'm like, that's what she said. And sort of that's sort of the style of humor, where it's like, it's just awful, awful sadness. And then there's sort of like, for those humorists in the audience who are like, enjoy sort of like comedy from a historical perspective, there's a little bit of like a wink to like terrible right. classic humor, but it's all about, and like, but in between that I sort of work in philosophical sort of like, what is happiness? And then like I have this thing about, you know, happiness is like a grapefruit, you know, it's a concrete thing that you can hold, but it's like a grapefruit. And there's a reason that I pick grapefruit as opposed to something sweeter, that it's a fruit, but it's a tart fruit, you know, it's something that's a little bit unpleasant, and like a kid doesn't quite grasp what happiness is right off the bat. Like a kid has it more uncomplicated, but as an adult, happiness is a grapefruit. You know, it's good for you.
What is it? Who's that character based on?
Me. I mean, to a certain extent, like, and there's a composite of different people I know that
me
I borrow things
from. Me in terms of what? Where's the sadness and the failure?
I think it's just there. I think, you know, like, that's just, there's a certain melancholia that I think runs through my family as well. And just in, you know, being sort of an atheistic-leaning agnostic, there's just sort of a constant reaffirmation of mortality, which is hard to escape. You know, like, oh, this is a limited thing we have, life. And, you know, there is sort of a feeling that there's an inevitable lessening that occurs after a certain point in life where we're growing, and now enter entropy, you know, where it's just disintegration and less. But at the same time, mentally is where we're allowed to, and emotionally we can keep growing our entire lives. Physically, materially, we don't, but...
What percentage is your dad in that character?
Oh, I mean, hugely. I mean, he's a huge part of me. I'm such a, like a marriage of my mother, and I am my mother and my father's marriage. She's very direct and forward moving and like the general. She runs things, and this is how things are done, and this is the right way to do things. And he's very much he's the emotional response to existence. Like, you know, he's happiness, he's joy, he's anger, he's sad, he's fear.
They almost have the roles reversed. The
yeah,
feminine
traditional
and,
gender yeah, roles are, yeah. I would say, yeah, absolutely.
So what do you want to do with this character that you created?
Well, what I like to do is I like to take him in front of audiences, and I like them. I like the fact that putting him in a stand-up setting as opposed to a performance setting, because I think when people come into like theatrical environments and one-person shows, they kind of expect drama a little bit, or potentially drama, and so they're ready for it. But if you put him in a stand-up environment, the audience, I think, is less prepared for, like... difficult things.
Right. You've got like built-in tension there
yeah.
with the audience.
Yeah, exactly. And like, and silence too. Like, I like to play with a lot of silence. And I think that there's, because it's indirect and unexpected, they're a little bit more vulnerable. And I like that because then I can take them on a journey perhaps that they weren't expecting, and because they weren't expecting it, it can access parts of them, deeper parts of them, and they can walk away with a little bit more than they were expecting to walk away on any given night. And then the other thing that I'm working on is I'm midway through a book called Dog Body, which is it was kind of started off as a jag-off premise.
What's a jag-off premise?
Well, because all these little kids, you know, like Justin Bieber and stuff, they're like writing these memoirs. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you're not alive. You're like 2 months old. How can you have a memoir?
Right.
And so
it ends when I graduate high school.
Yeah. You know, yeah. When I finally learned everything there is
right,
to learn.
Yeah. You should see the chapter I wrote on riding a bike.
Oh my goodness. It's about three sentences. Yeah. And it's just life changing.
Yeah.
But it's just, I get so frustrated and angry about these things. Cause I'm like, this is so cynical and so purposeless, and there's this huge audience that just devours these things, and I'm like, there's nobody questioning the value here or like the absurdity of it. So I was like, well, I'm still a young man, I should write my memoir, because it's, you know. But I was like, and that's the jag-off nature,
right?
I'm like, this is a fucking joke, but I'm like, it should be a joke that's worthwhile and slightly weird and commercially unviable. So I've decided to write it in the form of like 100 or so poems. There's some 14th century Chaucerian English poems, there's sonnets, there's Joyce, there's Rilke, there's Bukowski, there's giants, dragons, there's a talking Nazi gerbil. I mean, and these are all things that are like true to my life. Like, these are all characters that I sort of live with on a day-to-day period. And it's all true for the most part. Like, it's all memories. But they're all in the voices of my favorite poets or in the voices of my favorite writers and eras. And it's sort of non-chronological, non-sequential.
So you're speaking through these characters?
No, generally I speak everything through one character. This one, Horace Dogbody, mm-hmm. is the main character. Names have been changed. And then I sort of take all my circumstances and I either relate them truthfully as they occurred, half-truthfully, or as an elaborate tissue of fiction. But you get, I think, a real complete picture of what it's like to live inside of my head and my heart. Like, this is the true nature of how my imagination lives within this world, which is what I think would make it an interesting experience to read it.
We got to wrap this up, and I really want to thank you for...
Yeah.
But one last question. What are you happiest doing? Writing? Acting?
Improvising.
Really?
Yeah. I think it's the truest nature of the creative process. It's the heart of it. You're literally just creating on stage, and an audience is watching the process of creating. It's not about the result, and there's no editing. I mean, you know, there's editing, as we understand editing, which is like tagging in and changing
and sweep at it and starting over.
But in terms of editing, is like what is said is never unsaid, and so you're really getting to see the creative process unfold live in front of you and with an audience, and so together you go somewhere. And I think due to the nature of live performance, it's also impermanent and transient, and that at the end of the show it goes away. And even if you record it, you never really recapture what it was, only that one thing once. And I think that's really emblematic of life and living, which is that it happens once and then it goes away. I'm not one for the transmigration of the soul. So I think it captures for me all of my sort of beliefs about what life is like, and it's a full embrasure of the creative process at the same time, which I think is what matters. I think process is everything. Process takes care of itself. And so those two things together, yeah, how could you not love improv?
Lucas Neff, thank you so much. Check him out, Raising Hope.
Well, we're off air for a little bit, but normally we are Tuesdays at 8, and we just finished up season 3. I've heard they're re-airing season 3 this summer, but you can catch us the first two seasons on Netflix or iTunes on Apple TV. Stay tuned. We'll be airing again next fall.
So you're already picked up for...
Yeah, we start shooting July 29th.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, yeah. God bless, right?
Because you've never had, since you've got out there, you've never had to have a day job, right?
No. No, yeah. I'm a bastard.
What's that mean?
Oh, yeah. I came out to L.A. with a job, and the entirety of my experience of L.A. has been an actor who's working. so I'm lucky.
Do you get a lot of shit from that, from other people?
I assume I'm getting a lot of shit from it behind my back.
Okay. If I hear anything, I'll let you know. Thanks again.
Yeah.
Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy. Jimmy, Jimmy Corain.
And there you have it. It's another episode of Improv Nerd. And I want to thank our guest, Lucas Neff, who I just thought was so generous with his time. And if you get a chance, and we discussed in the interview, they are picking up Raising Hope. So it will be on for another season. So check that out on Fox. As always, I want to thank my producer, Ben Caprero, and the good people here at Hotel Lincoln. I mean, they went out of their way. They gave us a suite. When I showed up, there was a little note with a bottle of sparkling water. Even though I don't drink it, I was like, I felt like a rock star. So if you ever get a chance and you're in Chicago, it's not far from Second City, and it's a great location because it's right on the it's right on Lincoln Park, which is this beautiful park and a zoo. So check it out, Hotel Lincoln, and tell them that Improv Nerd sent you, because we just love their hospitality. It's kind of funky and kitschy, and I think that's enough of a plug. I think it's enough of a plug. Also, if you want more information on Improv Nerd or my award-winning classes, I'm also going to be doing in July, I'll be doing these one-day intensives. So if you're coming into Chicago and you want to study with me, and go to jimmycorain.com for more information. And please, please, please like Improv Nerd Facebook page. It's great for my low self-esteem. I really, really appreciate you guys listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island, yeah, and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
It might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you